18-year-old Lynn Burdick was an exceptional woman, a devoted student who achieved high marks, a loving sister, aunt, and daughter who dedicated much of her life to taking care of her family, and a deeply compassionate person who volunteered most of her free time to fundraising and charitable organizations. She was smart, focused, and reliable. She was always there when someone needed a hand, and she'd go the extra mile to ensure they got everything they needed. Until one stormy winter night, when Lynn mysteriously vanished. Scheduled to work the closing shift by herself at the local convenience store, even feeling a little under the weather, Lynn was determined to make it through. For several hours, she rang up customers during the busy evening, taking breaks to read and relax when the small parking lot fell empty. At 8 p.m., she spoke on the phone with her boss, but when the little bell above the door rang, Lynn ended the call, saying she had a customer she had to help and she'd call back, but she never did. In fact, Lynn was never seen again. Less than an hour later, police were notified of the teen's disappearance when a customer found the store abandoned. Door unlocked, lights on, register open and empty, and a small novel folded face down on the counter. Investigators immediately launched a massive search, heading out into a barrage of rain, snow, and hail, trying to find the missing teen. More than 40 years later, the same questions that haunted police and her family remain unanswered, and Lynn's fate has never been determined. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 188, The Vanishing of Lynn Burdick, Part 1. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we begin our examination of the mysterious disappearance of 18-year-old Lynn Burdick. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. This year, CrimeCon will be taking place in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I'll be there representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. If you're planning to attend, you can use promo code TRACE to save 10% off your ticket. For more information, visit crimecon.com and remember to use promo code TRACE to save 10%. I look forward to seeing you there. Lynn Burdick had made a habit out of being kind, caring, and reliable. She devoted much of her life to helping others, supporting her family, and building towards a future. Then one cold night, someone stole away all of her dreams and created a mystery that endures even four decades later. This is episode 188, The Vanishing of Lynn Burdick, Part 1. Route 2, also known as the Mohawk Trail, winds its way from Williamstown in the west to Greenfield in the east. Along the way, it passes through the small town of Florida, a tightly knit community that's home to beautiful vistas, wondrous forests, and heavy winter storms. At a small intersection between North Adams and Florida, Route 2 meets Shaft Road. Today, only green grass and the remnants of a small parking lot mark the spot as anything more than a barren street corner. But in 1982, it was home to the Barefoot Peddler, a small variety store, the only one, in fact, that existed in Florida at the time. While the structure has long since disappeared from the roadside, the ghosts of memory continue to haunt this isolated spot for many who remember that cold Saturday in April, when 18-year-old Lynn Burdick mysteriously vanished. Stepping inside, police found an abandoned counter holding an empty cash register and a novel, folded open and placed face down. Nearby, a half-drunk soda lingered beside a chair where the high school senior had been reading just minutes before. Investigators believed they would track down the teen within hours, battling the furious winter storm that came to town that night. Now, however, more than four decades later, the mystery of Lynn's disappearance and the identity of the person or persons who may have taken her remain at the core of a mystery that has yet to be unraveled. Lynn Marie Burdick was born on Tuesday, February 4th, 1964, to parents Rufus and Dorothy. Lynn would be the baby of the family, having two older sisters, Faye and Cynthia, and an older brother, Brian. Lynn was born and raised in the small Massachusetts town of Florida, located in the northeastern corner of Berkshire County. Located along the Mohawk Trail, Florida is an area known for its brutally cold winters and heavy snowfall, rather than the warmth and sunshine of its namesake. While being a part of the Pittsfield Metropolitan Statistical Area, Florida's population in the 1960s was well under 600, and today sits at just under 700. Many have defined the town as a close-knit, tight community where many of the residents are related, distantly in many cases. Lynn was doted on as the baby of the family and adored by her siblings and parents. Friends and family have described Lynn as deeply loving and compassionate, with a shy and quiet exterior. Many have noted, however, that once you got to know Lynn, she was funny, talkative, and honest. One of the most common terms used to describe her is reliable. Even from a young age, she was the type who went out of her way to help others, and if she said she'd be somewhere, there was no doubt she'd arrive early and ready to get the job done. Lynn grew up in a small wood frame house located along Central Shaft Road, half a mile south of Route 2, the Mohawk Trail, and just a few miles north of both the Savoy State Forest and Florida State Forest. Lynn was raised in the Florida Baptist Church, to which both her parents were members. She began her early years at school at Gabriel Abbott Memorial, a mile from home. Lynn was a good student who scored high marks with little effort, as she was noted as being highly intelligent even from a young age. Money was never in abundance in the Burdick household, with her father, Rufus, employed as a machine worker for the General Cable Company, while her mother, Dorothy, had previously worked for White's Laundry. Dorothy would ultimately fall ill, being diagnosed with emphysema and asthma, and as she grew older, Lynn dedicated much of her time to looking after her mother. Following her graduation from Gabriel Abbott, Lynn moved on to attend Charles H. McCann Technical School in nearby North Adams, where she majored in distributive education, receiving both classroom instruction and on-the-job training. Lynn had no illusions about the options available to her, knowing that her family couldn't afford to pay for her to attend college. This, however, didn't appear to have had a major impact on her work as she continued to achieve high marks, becoming a member of the National Honor Society. Her educational choices, it appears, were somewhat influenced by her knowledge that she'd be better equipped to go straight to work out of high school rather than relying on the necessity for higher education, something she hoped to achieve later in life. While distributive education doesn't necessarily sound like the most thrilling or exciting career path, at least one friend has shared that Lynn had broader dreams. Speaking to the Springfield Union, Cheryl Reynolds explained that Lynn wanted to be an artist, possibly a cartoonist, and maybe that was something she would have pursued had she gotten the chance. However, she also felt compelled to be there to look out for her mother, telling friends that she planned to be directly involved as a caretaker until she reached at least the age of 25. Outside of school, Lynn was also involved in a lot of activities, many of which revolved around volunteering her time to help others. In the summer of 1981, just a year prior to her disappearance, Lynn spent a week at Camp Echo as a buddy to her close friend, Therese Perot, who has muscular dystrophy. She often participated in benefits to raise funds and awareness for disorders and disabilities such as cerebral palsy. On Saturday nights, she regularly volunteered to keep score for the Berkshire Bombers, a special bowling league that focused on accessibility and was located in North Adams. When she wasn't volunteering her time outside of the house, she could often be found at home, looking after her mother, or babysitting nieces, nephews, and cousins. She didn't keep a great deal of time for herself, instead investing it in others and the community around her. In 1979, when Lynn turned 15, she was baptized in the church and picked up her first job. Just a half a mile from her home stood the Barefoot Peddler, a small convenience store that functioned as one of the only grocery locations in Florida. Lynn worked early weekend shifts running the cash register at the business, which was, at the time, owned and operated by a distant cousin, Gary Burdick, and his wife Suzanne. While she didn't make a great deal of money, Lynn was happy to be able to contribute to her family, and she was working on accumulating her own small savings account. Due to the close proximity of the store to her house, Lynn frequently walked or rode her bike to work, though when the brutal cold of winter came sweeping in, she'd often get picked up or dropped off by friends and family members when they were available. As Lynn began approaching the end of her time at McCann Technical, some friends noted that she'd begun to change. Known throughout much of her life as quiet, shy, and the type who didn't speak up and just took things as they came, she began shaping into an adult, and the shell she'd worn for so many years started to fracture. Several classmates have noted that in her final year at school, Lynn became more outspoken and independent, and when she felt someone had wronged her, she stood up for herself. According to her friend and classmate, Diana Bedini, Lynn had experienced some challenging times in her later teen years, and while many of her friends were dating, going out, and partying, she wasn't. At the time, she was one of 13 female students in the distributive education program, and they all got to know one another fairly well since they attended almost all of their classes together. Diana explained, quote, "I know she went through some difficult times, 12 of us with boyfriends, and she being the only one in the class without one," end quote. According to friends and family, Lynn was a straight arrow, for lack of a better term. She didn't smoke, drink, or even use foul language, and when it came to dating, there's no one who believes the interest wasn't there, but it appears that Lynn didn't see herself as the belle of the ball, and in the end, if no boys came calling, she wasn't going to cry herself to sleep over it. As the calendar changed and hit 1982, Lynn was a senior in high school with only a few months to go before graduation. While, of course, going out into the adult world was surely on her mind, she was focused on what was to be the last hurrah for her class, senior prom. Though she didn't appear to have a particular partner in mind, Lynn was determined to attend the big event even if she went solo, though, according to her friends, they were planning to make sure she was a part of their group. Knowing her family couldn't afford to buy her an expensive dress, Lynn began socking away savings from work to pick up one on her own. Perhaps this added some extra excitement to her 18th birthday that February, as this now allowed her to work longer shifts and gave her the legal ability to sell both cigarettes and alcohol, two major draws at the Barefoot Peddler. Her weekend shifts, typically completed during the early part of the day, would now change, and she'd often be assigned closing shifts on the weekends where the store was almost always busier and she'd be working alone. Most times, however, she wasn't truly alone, as her dear friend Therese would drop by the store and hang out until closing, and oftentimes when Therese wasn't available, store owner Suzanne would hang around and look after her. Suzanne would later explain to the Boston Globe, quote, "Although we had never had any problems with customers, I just felt safer having another person around," end quote. At 18, Lynn was living at home in the small wood house on Central Shaft Road, sharing it with her parents, aunt, uncle, and two cousins. Lynn's room was located on the top floor, a division of the attic, whose arched ceiling left only enough space to stand fully upright along one of its walls, but she didn't seem to mind. Lynn was a collector, who never got rid of anything she thought could see additional use, and as such, had boxes in her room which held all of her childhood toys she planned to gift to her nieces and nephews as they grew up. In the months before her disappearance, the house would become a little more cramped as her brother Brian, along with his wife and children, would have to move in for a time after a fire destroyed their home. Regardless of the circumstances, it appears Lynn was glad to have her family close and to be able to help them out whenever necessary. As April of 82 rolled around, both graduation and the prom were quickly approaching. Lynn continued to maintain her busy schedule, volunteering, attending school, looking after her mother, and working weekends at the Barefoot Peddler. She was approaching the amount of money she'd been seeking to purchase her prom dress, and she was beginning to get excited about what possibilities lay in her future. Unfortunately, Lynn's future would forever be altered on a quiet Saturday night when she arrived for her shift at work and mysteriously vanished from behind the counter. Saturday, April 17th, began as a normal day for Lynn, who awoke in her bedroom at the house on Central Shaft Road. That evening, Lynn was scheduled to work the closing shift at the Peddler, which was set to close at 9 p.m. According to her mother, Dorothy, she and Lynn took a short shopping trip into North Adams that afternoon. Dorothy later told the Springfield Union that Lynn was specifically looking for a lock for her 10-speed bike, and she found one. Former Florida Police Chief Charles Briggs later noted in a discussion with the North Adams Transcript that sometime that Saturday, Lynn also had attended a get-together at the Florida Lounge. Briggs was never able to obtain a lot of information about it, noting that he'd questioned other attendees, but no one could remember how long Lynn had been there, nor anyone she may have spent time talking to. According to Dorothy, she dropped her daughter off for her Saturday shift just before 4 p.m. The two hugged and exchanged I love yous, having no idea that this would be the last time they would ever see one another. The sky had begun growing overcast as a winter storm approached. While temperatures lingered in the 50s, they would start to drop as the sun fell beneath the horizon and evening settled in. Sadly, this would end up being one of the rare Saturday nights in which Lynn would be entirely alone at the store. Her close friend Therese was in Boston for a bowling tournament, and her boss Suzanne was at home looking after a child who was sick with the flu. According to the Berkshire Eagle, Lynn herself may have been feeling under the weather that night, possibly in the early stages of the flu, but despite her mother's protests, Lynn said she was scheduled to work, and that's where she was going to be. Despite being homesick with her child, Suzanne made it a point to call and check in on Lynn as she often did when the 18-year-old was scheduled alone. As far as has ever been reported, there doesn't appear to have been any problems or incidents in the store during the first few hours. Based on statements issued by law enforcement, at least three people either spoke with or directly encountered Lynn at the store that night. Her older sister, Faye, told the Springfield Union that she'd spoken to Lynn on the phone, though she didn't think the call was exactly normal, saying, quote, "She sounded strange, kind of short, and when I called back several times, there was no answer," end quote. This call has been reported as having occurred at approximately 7:30 p.m. Manager and co-owner Suzanne Burdick next reports to have spoken to Lynn on the phone approximately 25 minutes later, around 7:55. According to Suzanne, Lynn noted that the store was busy that night, likely due to both it being Saturday and with the storm coming, people wanted to load up on supplies. During this call, Suzanne later stated that Lynn left the phone on the counter for a few minutes as she walked out of the store to help load bags for a customer who was on crutches, before returning and continuing the conversation. Sometime between 8 and 8:05, Suzanne overheard the bell above the store's door ring, and Lynn ended the conversation, saying that she had a new customer and needed to get off the phone. This has been reported as the last time anyone managed to reach Lynn over the phone that night. Roy Burdick, a third cousin of Lynn's and the former owner of the Barefoot Peddler, told the North Adams Transcript that he dropped by the store that night to pick up supplies. Roy stated, quote, "I stopped by with a van full of teenagers because we were having a youth dance that night. She wanted to go, but she couldn't because she had to work," end quote. According to Roy, his visit to the store occurred at approximately 8:10, making him one of the last people to see Lynn that night before she vanished. He didn't report any suspicious characters, nor did he seem to think Lynn was behaving in any manner to suggest that something was wrong. While it's never directly stated, it seems to have been implied that during this stop, Roy didn't see any other customers nor any cars in the parking lot. What exactly occurred over the course of the next 30 minutes has been the source of great debate and immense frustration for nearly 40 years. According to the family, they placed multiple phone calls to the store between 8:10 and 8:40, but never got an answer. With temperatures dropping and the storm rolling in, they were trying to reach Lynn to find out whether or not she'd be wanting a ride home or if she'd walked the 0.6 mile that night. The final unanswered call has been noted as being made at approximately 8:30, and it was by Dorothy, but like the others, it just rang and was never answered. Now, there are two slightly different accounts of what occurred next. Many articles have reported that a customer entered the store at 8:40 and found the door open, lights on, but the building abandoned. This person, who was friends with the Burdick family and knew Lynn, quickly picked up the phone and called her parents to report that she wasn't there. Other articles state that following the 8:30 call from Dorothy, she was worried and requested that her son Brian head down the street to check on his sister. Arriving at approximately 8:40, Brian found the store in the same condition previously described, abandoned with the lights on and door unlocked. Worried about Lynn, Brian quickly picked up the store's phone and called the Florida Police Department to report his sister missing. At the time, the Florida Police Department was a part-time force overseen by Chief Charles Briggs, who reported that he was notified of Lynn's disappearance at approximately 8:50, 10 minutes after the initial call was made. Units were quickly directed to the Barefoot Peddler, located at the intersection of the Mohawk Trail and Shaft Road. Police later described the store as being small on the inside, housing a U-shaped counter which held the cash register, as well as trays of candy, cigarettes, and small trinkets and good luck charms. The first thing officers noticed upon arriving was that the store appeared to be in good condition. Nothing had been knocked over, and there were no overt or obvious signs that a struggle had taken place. At the time, this led them to theorize that Lynn had either left of her own volition or had been abducted by someone who may have brandished a weapon, or perhaps this person had lured her outside. Chief Briggs explained details of the scene, saying, quote, "There was a chair beside a small table at the end of the counter, on which was an open bottle of soda and a small book turned face down, indicating that she'd been reading there and planned to return," end quote. The absence of a struggle at the time led investigators to hold out some hope that Lynn may have been abducted, but perhaps the suspect didn't have violent intentions. Searching further in the store, they quickly found that the cash register had been rifled through, and tallying up the receipt tape would confirm that $187 was missing. A quick examination of the receipt tape also indicated that the last completed transaction in the store was for a purchase of beer, cigarettes, and candy. Unfortunately, at the time, the cash register didn't record timestamps from when transactions occurred, so there was no way of knowing for certain if Lynn had been missing for 5 minutes, or if 10 or perhaps 20 minutes had elapsed. As investigators continued looking around, they quickly discovered a sum of money in a lockbox beneath the counter. As the store would become busier, money drops were often made in the box for security purposes, so that should someone come in demanding money from the register, they wouldn't get the larger sum of the full day's haul. According to police, Lynn was well aware of the lockbox, and being that it had been left untouched, they believed that the robber had demanded money from the register but wasn't aware of that box. Perhaps more notable than what was left behind was that which was missing. In addition to Lynn, it was reported that both her purse and her Charles H. McCann technical school jacket were gone. Quickly noting that Lynn may have been forcibly abducted, Chief Briggs requested that all available units begin an immediate search of the area. At the time, he also reached out to the Massachusetts State Police and requested their assistance in the search, since his own force was rather small and they had a lot of ground to cover. Multiple units began sweeps of all roadways in the town. However, as the weather continued to worsen, rain, hail, snow, and high winds creating large snowdrifts were hampering their ability to search everything as closely as they would have liked. At the time, there was already areas of town covered with as much as 4 feet of snow, and it was only getting deeper as the new storm swung into action. However, what no one yet knew was that Lynn might not have been the only woman in the area targeted that night. Approximately 1 hour earlier, around 7:50 p.m., a female student at Williams College, 14 miles west of Florida, had narrowly escaped the clutches of an abductor. According to Williamstown Police Chief Joseph Zoido, an unidentified man called out to the student in the area of Dodd House, a campus dorm. This man apparently lured the woman over to his vehicle by showing her a map and asking for directions. When the woman got near to the vehicle, the man sprung into action, grabbing her and trying to force her into the car. Luckily, the woman fought back hard and bit down, sinking her teeth into the assailant's hand, possibly in the area of his right thumb. When the man released her in reaction to the bite, the student managed to escape and notified the police. At the time, they weren't able to release much of a description of the suspect, though his car was noted as being a dark-colored, late-model vehicle in good condition, with light blue interior, floor console, bucket seats, and rectangular-shaped taillights. An unknown caller contacted the state police not long after the attempted abduction, reporting that he had witnessed a dark green or blue vehicle with rectangular headlights heading eastbound along Route 2. This caller reported that the vehicle was moving at a high rate of speed and had been erratically passing other vehicles on the road. According to this witness, the driver of the car had pulled over at a payphone along Route 2 between North Adams and Williamstown sometime between 7:45 and 8 p.m. A similar vehicle was later described by another witness as traveling at a high rate of speed along Route 2, just a few miles from and heading in the direction of the Barefoot Peddler. Considering the weather that night and the conditions of the road, investigators estimated that it would have taken no less than 20 minutes to travel from the scene of the attempted abduction to the Barefoot Peddler. This would mean that the assailant, if indeed he was heading that way, could have arrived at the convenience store any time after 8:10, right in the window of time during which Lynn vanished. While investigators had no way of knowing with any certainty whether or not the abduction attempt was directly connected to Lynn's disappearance, it was the best they had to work with at the time. Asked about it later, State Police Detective Robert Scott could not confirm that the suspect was the same in both cases, though he did note, quote, "It's quite a coincidence they occurred within about 40 minutes of each other," end quote. Search parties organized that night had to confront the assault of the winter storm while also dealing with a wide array of main roads, side streets, and rural areas scattered in and around Florida. Chief Briggs confirmed that different search groups were sent down to the two nearby national parks to look for any signs of recent vehicle traffic or any clues which might indicate that Lynn had been there. Unfortunately, as snow continued to accumulate and the weather grew hostile, most searchers found themselves sticking primarily to major roads. As the night grew late and the environment more dangerous, law enforcement continued searching with plans of organizing a larger search effort in the morning. Chief Briggs spearheaded much of the efforts, taking only a short break to grab a cup of coffee at his house around 4 a.m. before heading back out. Back at the wooden house on Central Shaft Road, Lynn's family were devastated by the news. While at the time investigators had no way of knowing for certain whether or not Lynn had been abducted, or perhaps had chosen to go off on her own, there was no one who knew the 18-year-old that believed the latter was even a remote possibility. Her sister-in-law, Bernadette, speaking to the North Adams Transcript, made the family's opinion clear. Lynn was not the type to just run off. She was very close with her parents and siblings and had given no indication of a desire to be anywhere else. As she explained, Lynn never went anywhere without telling her mother, and she was devoted to looking after her. Running away was simply not an option. When the interviews with friends and acquaintances resulted in similar statements, investigators acknowledged that this theory was unlikely. Detective Scott explained, quote, "There's no reason to believe she just took off. They love this girl. She's the salt of the earth up there. They trusted her implicitly," end quote. By sunrise on Sunday, April 18th, word had already circulated throughout the small town and hundreds of people began volunteering their time, abilities, and equipment to assist in searches for the missing high school senior. The Florida Volunteer Fire Department building became the central hub for organization of searches, which by morning would include locals, as well as members of the fire department, Florida police, and state police. At the time, Robert Burdick, a distant cousin of Lynn's, was captain of the fire department. Early estimates noted that approximately 120 people were involved in Sunday's search, which included a primary focus on covering every inch of Florida, as well as neighboring Monroe to the northeast and Savoy to the south. More searchers were dispatched to state forests and utilized four-wheel drive vehicles to tackle some of the rougher terrain, much of which had been blanketed by snow the previous night. On the one hand, tracks through the snow would be easy to spot, but on the other, the snow could also help cover up tire tracks or footprints left along side roads and in the wilderness. Other volunteers took to the areas on foot, trying to make their way through the dense foliage and along steep embankments in hopes of finding something, anything, to suggest where Lynn may have been taken. Much of Lynn's family also joined in on the search efforts, with Rufus leading the way, determined to track down his daughter and bring her home. Unfortunately, Sunday's searches yielded few, if any, answers. Despite covering a large area in and surrounding Florida, investigators hadn't managed to track down the slightest hint of where she might be. No footprints, articles of clothing, candy wrappers, nothing to give them a direction to move in. Hoping to produce better results for Monday, Chief Briggs reached out for additional assistance, requesting that the state police supply helicopters and planes. Briggs also made several public pleas, requesting anyone who was able to join in the search. Specifically, he hoped for hunters and outdoorsmen who knew the wooded areas better than the average citizen. By 10 a.m. on Monday, April 19th, approximately 45 people had assembled at the fire department, including volunteers from the fire departments of nearby Clarksburg and Rowe. While search parties were organized and dispatched to different areas, they were joined by two helicopters, one sent up by the state police and the other supplied by the Department of Natural Resources. Aerial searches focused on wooded areas, main roads, and various waterways in the area, with helicopters dropping down to as low as 6 feet above the water's surface to give searchers a better chance of seeing something that might be below. While many of the search parties focused on the outdoors, others were put together, which were to inspect and examine every vacant building in and around Florida, from all collapsing hunting cabins to empty houses. The search radius expanded even further, now to include parts of Charlemont, North Adams, and even crossing the state line to the north into South Reedsboro, Vermont. We'll get back into discussing these searches after a quick word from this week's sponsors. I don't know if it's the accents or the tea or the driving on the wrong side of the road, but no matter what it is, I love British TV, and I'm getting my fill and then some thanks to Eggcorn TV. Eggcorn TV is the largest commercial-free British streaming service that features compelling stories, exclusive premieres, and originals you won't find anywhere else. Eggcorn has hundreds of exclusive shows from around the world, including award-winning mysteries, dramas, comedies, history, and so much more. The series you find on Eggcorn TV are cleverly written, visually striking, and feature renowned actors and hosts like David Tennant and Mary Berry. Most recently, I've fallen down the rabbit hole with Under the Vines. Starring Rebecca Gibney and Charles Edwards, this dramedy follows two unlikely city slickers who inherit a failing vineyard in rural New Zealand. Despite neither having ever done a hard day's work in their lives and both despising the other, they somehow make a vineyard successful so they can sell up, split up, and get out of there. Under the Vines is a quirky, well-written show with an awesome setting and a fantastic cast. The conflict at the core of the show leads to hilarious arguments and remarks that had me laughing out loud. If you love a good gut laugh like I do, then you've got to check out Under the Vines. And with Eggcorn TV, it's never been easier. You get thousands of hours of new, enthralling content on Eggcorn TV for a fraction of the cost compared to most streaming services at just $5.99 a month. I love how I can watch my new favorite British TV shows at home, on my Firebox, when I'm traveling on my laptop, and even on my phone when I'm sitting around waiting for my next appointment. With Eggcorn TV, I always get my British fix, and you can too. Try Eggcorn TV free for 30 days by going to eggcorn.tv and using my promo code TRACE. But you have to enter the code in all lowercase letters. That's ACORN.TV promo code TRACE to get your first 30 days for free. Acorn.tv, code TRACE. I love that sound. The sound of another sale on Shopify, the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. Shopify gives entrepreneurs the resources once reserved for big business, so upstarts, startups, and established businesses alike can sell everywhere, synchronize online and in-person sales, and effortlessly stay informed. Scaling your business is a journey of endless possibility. I love how Shopify has the tools and resources that make it easy for any business to succeed, from down the street to around the globe. Like mine, Shopify powers over 1.7 million businesses, from first sale to full scale. Reach customers online and across social networks with an ever-growing suite of channel integrations and apps, including Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, and more. Gain insights as you grow with detailed reporting of conversion rates, profit margins, and beyond. More than a store, Shopify grows with you. This is possibility powered by Shopify. Go to shopify.com/trace, all lowercase, for a free 14-day trial and get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to shopify.com/trace right now. There's nothing better than curling up on the couch and watching a great mystery thriller. I love to grab a bucket of popcorn, a warm blanket, and a cool drink to snuggle in and have my heart thrilled and my mind chilled. If you're anything like me, then I've got the perfect one for you to watch next. Spectrum Originals' Angela Black. And you can binge all of the episodes now for free on demand on Spectrum. In this new character-driven, six-part psychological thriller, we'll follow Angela Black, a woman whose reality is upended when she's approached by a mysterious man carrying an ominous warning. Nothing is as it seems as she tries to save herself and her children from danger, leading Angela to doubt everything she thought she knew, including her own mind. All episodes of Angela Black are available to binge now, free, on demand, on Spectrum. The series stars actors we've all loved, from Golden Globe winner Joanne Froggatt, who played Anna Bates in Downton Abbey, to Mikhail Huseman from The Flight Attendant. The minute I saw the Angela Black trailer, I knew I'd binge the entire series. I was immediately sucked into this dark, slow-burning thriller that transforms the quiet comfort of your own home into a space reserved for terror. I'm telling you, you have to start watching Angela Black today. Binge all of the episodes for free on demand on Spectrum. That's Spectrum Originals, Angela Black. Unfortunately, Monday's search results were much as the previous days had been, so when searching began for the fourth official day on Tuesday, April 20th, even more people came to try and contribute whatever they could. The local Civil Air Patrol became involved, supplying a light search plane to widen the radius. In addition to this, a local Connecticut news station, WFSB out of Hartford, brought another helicopter to help out. As the search party grew, they continued to pour over some areas which had already been searched, while also expanding into different locations that had previously been outside of the scope. A third helicopter supplied by the Beverly District Attorney's Office also joined in, executing a spiral search beginning at the Barefoot Peddler and working its way out in wider and wider circles. Beyond those who had volunteered to participate, the Florida police and state police were inundated with hundreds of calls from people providing tips. Some claimed to have seen Lynn in the hours or days after her disappearance. Others believed they might have seen someone acting suspicious, or that they had seen the car which had been involved in the attempted abduction at Williams College. All told, by Tuesday afternoon, police had fielded just over 300 phone calls and were attempting to track down all potential leads. The Burdick family themselves were also receiving calls from tipsters, most of which they directed back to the police. However, a series of so-called psychics began reaching out claiming to have knowledge of, or merely wanting to offer assistance in, the search for Lynn. That afternoon, for the first time, investigators thought they could have possibly had a new lead. A group of searchers working in the area of Strikers Road, less than a mile and a half from the store, discovered an abandoned house which appeared to have been broken into. When investigators were notified, they arrived quickly and began a sweep of the home. It was clear that someone had forced their way in due to damage to the door. In the structure, they found areas where dust and spider webs had been disturbed by someone, and while the fireplace remained cold and didn't appear to have been used, they did find the imprint of a human shape in one of the beds, as well as palm and fingerprints on dust-covered furniture. Whether or not this was connected to Lynn's abduction, or perhaps had been done by someone looking for a place to spend the cold night, has never been determined. While searches were ongoing, a team of investigators at the Barefoot Peddler had begun working to try and gather up any forensic evidence that might be there. Despite the likelihood of uncovering a large amount of fingerprints in and around the building, they decided to dust for them anyway, and even began applying chemicals to various products throughout the store in hopes of getting a hit. In the end, however, they never managed to pick up on any prints or pieces of evidence which they believe were connected to Lynn's disappearance. As the night began growing late, searches were mostly wrapped up for the evening, though many members of Lynn's family and close friends continued their own searches well into the dark. Detective Scott, asked about Tuesday's efforts, explained to the Berkshire Eagle, quote, "Together, the two choppers covered most of Florida, though you couldn't say thoroughly. That would take 8 weeks. The terrain is rough up there. It's just awful," end quote. That Tuesday night was also a difficult reminder for many of the large role Lynn played in the lives of so many, as she missed her scheduled appearance at a fundraiser for cerebral palsy, where she was set to roller skate. On Wednesday, April 21st, Chief Briggs announced that the primary focus of their search for the day would be on the main roads leading out of Florida. Searchers were being asked to look for anything that might be a clue, whether it was a car on the side of the road, tire tracks in an unusual place, or perhaps even something Lynn may have tossed out of the car in hopes of leaving behind a trail. Approximately 40 searchers on foot and in cars combed Route 2 from Florida as far east as Shelburne, 30 miles away. Others focused in on Route 116, heading south into Savoy, while others still turned towards Deerfield, as well as parts of Searsburg, Reedsboro, Woodford, and Molly State Park in Vermont. In addition to this, helicopters were sent to scour the Taconic Range of the Appalachian Mountains, which run along the border between Massachusetts and New York to the west. Asked about progress on the searches thus far, Chief Briggs tried to remain positive about the lack of any signs yet discovered, telling the Eagle, quote, "They're looking for a body, clothing, anything lost or dropped, anything of that nature would give us a lead. I still got hope. We haven't come up with anything on the road, and that makes me feel better. There's still a lot of people taking time out from work," end quote. Briggs noted that, while not finding anything could be frustrating, it may also open up the possibility that Lynn could be in the area or one of the surrounding towns being held against her will. And while that was a frightening thought, it was better than the alternative of what dark fate she could possibly have met at the hands of her abductor. Outside of the searches, Chief Briggs once again made a plea to the public, though this time he was searching for answers from a different group of people. 4 long days after Lynn had last been seen, no one who had been to the Barefoot Peddler that Saturday night had yet come forward to talk to authorities. Briggs noted that even if someone didn't believe they had any helpful information, they never knew what small detail might unlock the mystery. In addition to this, they were hoping to hear from the anonymous caller who had previously reported seeing a dark-colored vehicle with rectangular taillights driving erratically that Saturday night along Route 2. As of that time, the caller had not called back nor revealed his identity. By the end of Wednesday's searches, Chief Briggs began to consider the likelihood that Lynn had been taken out of the area, noting that many parts of Florida had been searched as many as 5 times over, and that the search had covered almost every square foot of ground in a 50-mile radius, with the Barefoot Peddler at the center. By this time, the outcome was beginning to seem more and more grim, as Lynn's cousin and the Florida Fire Department Captain Robert Burdick noted, saying, quote, "It's a search where you hope you don't find anything. You know what I mean," end quote. Chief Briggs remarked that so much area had been covered with nothing found, and many volunteers had to return to their jobs and couldn't commit their time to trying to find Lynn any longer. While he called off official searches, Briggs noted that he would continue to direct volunteers so long as they continued to show up. On Thursday, April 22nd, it was officially reported that the Vermont State Police had discovered a 1978 Pontiac Phoenix in Somerset, approximately 30 miles north of Florida. That car, which had been reported stolen by a resident on Saturday night, had been torched. The vehicle was described as being painted green, with a light blue interior, and it possessed rectangular taillights. While for many, this raised the possibility that Lynn may have been taken somewhere into Vermont, Massachusetts State Police were less excited by the discovery, feeling that the vehicle did not fully fit the description of what they had been looking for, as the Pontiac had a bench seat, not bucket seats. As volunteers began to dwindle, Lynn's family continued their efforts to try and track her down. By Thursday, Rufus and several friends and family members had thoroughly searched large swaths of the backwoods areas, but hadn't found anything of importance. Some had gone to the Hoosick Tunnel, a 4 3/4 mile long railroad tunnel that runs under Florida Mountain from the Deerfield River to North Adams, searching by flashlight through the darkness. Different family members traveled up into Vermont and conducted searches around where the burned-out Pontiac had been found, while others hit every rest stop along the way from the Vermont border to Springfield, showing pictures of Lynn and asking if anyone had seen her. Speaking to the North Adams Transcript, Rufus noted that an alleged clairvoyant had contacted the family and reported that, according to her vibrations, Lynn was still alive, though she could not give any additional information. Asked about the searches and his hopes to find Lynn, Rufus explained, quote, "You've got to have hope. We still have hope. I'll search the rest of this week and mornings whenever I can. I'm running out of ideas and places to check. We just hope we find something she might have dropped out of the car to get an idea of where they might have gone. I don't know how it's possible. She must have been incapacitated or something to prevent her from throwing something out. I just wish the guy would call." End quote. Asked about new information or leads, Chief Briggs stated they'd received multiple calls from anonymous males who would say that Lynn was alive, but then they would hang up. They couldn't be certain at the time if the calls were legitimate or pranks. By Friday, April 23rd, nearly a full week had passed, and there hadn't been a single piece of evidence nor a solid trace of Lynn found, despite hundreds of volunteers spending countless hours searching throughout a 50-mile radius. In hopes of finding something, anything, to move the case forward, Chief Briggs announced the organization of a full-scale search of the town, set to take place across Saturday and Sunday. Briggs also announced that deputies from the Berkshire County Sheriff's Office had been called in to assist, and they'd be focusing on the Hoosack Tunnel and the North Pond area. Rufus and other family members would join the sheriff's deputies for their leg of the search. That Saturday's search failed to produce any results, and on Sunday, Chief Briggs enlisted the help of the Massachusetts Electric Company, who agreed to hold back the waters from the Bear Swamp Reservoir, dropping levels in the Deerfield River. Donald White, a Florida police officer, told the North Adams Transcript that water levels had been dropped approximately 6 feet, widening the riverbanks for cover on foot and allowing searchers to see to the bottom of the river. Volunteers covered the river, stretching from Bear Swamp all the way to Shelburne, but again, nothing was found. While the approximately 50 searchers worked the river, a prayer service was held for Lynn at the Florida Baptist Church. On Monday, April 25th, Captain Burdick announced that the Florida Volunteer Fire Department would be withdrawing from future searches, saying, quote, "We've exhausted every possibility," end quote. According to Chief Briggs, they received multiple calls to search a powerhouse, but several searches of areas fitting the description they were given turned up empty. Personnel at the Bear Swamp Visitor Center, 30 miles southeast of Florida, checked power company roads in the surrounding area. At the Dunbar Brook Picnic area, 10 miles west of town, they discovered someone had opened a gate blocking a pathway to the Deerfield River's No. 5 power station. A rusty chain which blocked access to roads leading to canals 2 and 3 was reported missing, though beyond that, no trace of any activity nor of Lynn was found during these searches. Thomas Curl, a state trooper out of the Pittsfield Barracks, told the Bennington Banner, quote, "They checked and rechecked all the areas from Greenfield to North Adams, going through the woods and dirt roads for any clues, and they found nothing." End quote. Frustrated, Rufus told reporters that he and his family would continue to search in the evenings when they got off work, but they couldn't afford to keep taking days off. He hadn't been able to participate in much of the searching that weekend, as Dorothy had grown ill and he had to take care of her. He did manage, however, to appear on a radio broadcast from WMNB in North Adams, where he made a desperate plea for the abductor to allow his daughter to call home and at least tell them that she was alive. Following that weekend, Chief Briggs called off future search efforts for the moment, explaining to the Springfield Union, quote, "We've been at it all week, every day, and people have been taking time off from work. The minute I get some good information, I'll sound the alarm, and we'll get everyone back together again." End quote. Meanwhile, the state police announced that three officers from their Crime Prevention and Control Unit, or CPAC, would still be working full-time on the case, and that any tips or leads called in would be followed up on as soon as possible. The Burdick family would continue carrying out their own searches. Asked about a possible link between Lynn's disappearance and the attempted abduction of the Williams College student, Jim Obermeyer, a spokesman for the Berkshire County District's Attorney's Office, told the Union, quote, "They haven't dismissed it, but then they haven't found anything else to bolster it either." End quote. Hoping to assist in the search for Lynn, a local group organized by the Beer family of North Adams began handing out posters showing Lynn and describing the details of her disappearance. They also supplied more than 150 businesses with donation canisters, as they hoped to gather funds which could be offered as a reward for information. It was thought at the time the reward money might encourage local hunters and fishermen to keep their eyes open when they were out in the wilderness. Students from McCann Technical School, Drury Senior High, and Gabriel Abbott volunteered to conduct door-to-door donation collections, and the Beer family noted that they hoped to raise $1,000 in that week. On Thursday, April 29th, nearly 2 weeks after Lynn's disappearance, the Berkshire County District Attorney's Office officially released a sketch of the suspect in the attempted abduction that occurred at Williams College. The assailant was described as being a white male in his mid-30s, 5 feet 10 inches tall and overweight with a pot belly. The man had ear-length brown hair parted to one side. He was clean-shaven and did not wear glasses. On the night of the attack, he was wearing a dark jacket, possibly a windbreaker, and was driving a late model car, dark in color with a light blue interior, bucket seats, and rectangular taillights. This composite was distributed to all police forces in Berkshire County, as well as to departments in neighboring states. It was also announced that the Massachusetts State Police were in contact with authorities in Marin County in the state of Florida, where a similar crime had occurred. 18-year-old Francis Julius Slater was abducted on Tuesday, April 27th from a Stewart variety store. Tragically, her body was later recovered in a field not far from the scene of the crime. Much like had been the case with Lynn's disappearance, the cash register had been cleared out, there were no signs of a struggle, and there had never been any ransom demands issued. While it was somewhat of a stretch, investigators noted that they were clinging to any crime that shared similarities, and though they had no reason to believe there would be a connection, they were being as thorough as possible in the hopes of finding answers. Sadly, the month of April would come to a bitter end for investigators and Lynn's family, as in more than 2 weeks, not a single trace of the 18-year-old or her abductor was found. On Monday, May 4th, the Barefoot Peddler was officially closed by Gary and Suzanne Burdick, though they didn't comment on the reasoning behind this move. For the first time since the mid-1950s, when it was known as Bob's Store, the building, which had been family-owned for the vast majority of his existence, would not open its doors. On this same day, The Beer family announced that their fundraising had surpassed their initial goal, and over the week they'd managed to collect $2,500, more than $7,000 in 2022 money, and it was all being offered up as a reward for information leading to Lynn's safe return or the arrest and conviction of the person responsible for her abduction. They officially ended the fund drive at that time, removing canisters from local businesses and halting door-to-door operations. The money would be held in a local bank account where only Chief Briggs could have direct access to the distribution of the funds. Sunday, May 9th, marked the first Mother's Day that Lynn wasn't at the Burdick home since the day she was born. The stress of the search for her was hard on Dorothy, who was already struggling with medical issues. Interviewed by the Eagle, Dorothy noted how difficult the whole situation had been, and not just on her, noting that it was tearing Lynn's father apart as well. Brian and Rufus shared their beliefs that Lynn had to have been taken out of Florida, announcing that they'd already traveled to larger cities such as Springfield and Boston, believing that perhaps the abductor had forced Lynn into sex work and might even be controlling her through the use of narcotics. Frustrated and worn after nearly a month of endless searching, Rufus sighed and sadly said, quote, "The worst thing is not having her here, not knowing where she is or anything," end quote. On Friday, May 14th, Chief Briggs announced that a new search was being organized for the upcoming weekend based on tips that had been called in the previous week. Volunteers, including many of Lynn's classmates and local Boy Scout troops, gathered at the fire department at 9:30 a.m. on Saturday the 15th. Those who showed up were divided into separate groups to focus searches on the north, south, and bog ponds in the Savoy State Forest south of town. In addition, Tilda Hill Road, which leads northwest from Florida to Monroe, would also be searched, focusing in on ditches along the roadside and the surrounding wilderness. Asked for additional information about these tips, Briggs told the Springfield Union that both the Florida Police Department and the state police had received separate, anonymous calls pointing them to search in these areas. Both calls indicated that Lynn's body would be located in the Savoy Forest or perhaps near the former Monroe State Prison work camp. Approximately 30 searchers were involved in these efforts, which also included aerial searches by helicopter and plane. Despite spending hours covering the area on foot, using four-wheel vehicles, and covering it from the sky, these searches failed to produce any results. Briggs later commented, quote, "We learned nothing, but we will check out every tip. But I do wish the cranks would stop calling. It was our last chance for an aerial search as the leaves are beginning to come out," end quote. As spring approached, the blooming foliage would make the forest too densely camouflaged to be adequately searched from the sky moving forward. Following the completion of these searches with nothing new discovered, Dorothy's health fell worse, and on Monday the 17th, she had to be rushed to the hospital in North Adams. She would eventually recover and get to return home, but the failure to find any trace of Lynn would continue to weigh heavy on her, both emotionally and physically. In late May, the final day of classes at McCann Technical School concluded, and in early June, the students gathered for their graduation. In an empty seat where Lynn was meant to have been sitting, only a bouquet of yellow flowers lie in her place. That year, the high school yearbook was dedicated to her and reads, quote, "Lynn Burdick, our classmate, has been missing since the night of April 17th when she disappeared from the store in which she was working. Although everything humanly possible has been done to find Lynn, her disappearance is still a mystery. Wherever you may be, Lynn, our thoughts and prayers are with you," end quote. Back home, at the old wood-framed house on Central Shaft Road, time passed slowly, and the weekend of graduation was a difficult reality to accept. The Burdicks had hoped to photograph their beautiful daughter as she went off to her senior prom, but that time came and went. They'd look forward to watching her graduate with high marks and honors, but that time, too, had come and gone. Both Chief Briggs and the Berkshire County District's Attorney's Office acknowledged that, in the months that had passed, tips and leads had all but dried up. Each day, Her family still move past the abandoned facade of the barefoot peddler on their way to work, to the store, to anywhere they had to go. The small, dark building hung like a specter, haunting the family with the mystery at its core. Despite this, however, the Burdicks continued to cling to the slim hope that Lynn would make it home, and each night before bed, they flipped on the front floodlights to light the way for her. According to the family, the light was for Lynn and Lynn alone, so she could find her way back in the dark. Asked about his daughter, Rufus told the Eagle, quote, "I think about her every day, every time I go by the store. I really do. At this point, we're at a standstill. It seems to have petered out." Next week, in part two of our look into the vanishing of Lynn Burdick, we'll explore the nearly 40 years of investigation that have passed since April of 1982. A slew of unsolved disappearances and homicides in the area, which some believe suggest an unknown serial killer was stalking Massachusetts in the 70s and 80s. An anonymous letter sent to the Burdick family, pointing the finger towards a suspect close to home, and the status of the case today and what has been learned over the passing of four decades. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod. Message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. Just a quick reminder that I'll be attending CrimeCon in Las Vegas, representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. To save 10% off your pass, use promo code TRACE at CrimeCon.com. Trace Evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers: Alicia Lorraine, Anne Bertram, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Denise Dingsdale, Donna Buttram, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Eloanne Meyer, Eric Sumpter, Guillerme Pinto, Haley Christie, James, Jen Treb, Jennifer Winkler, Jill Sentz, Joni Berkowitz, Julie Mangano, Kara Moreland, Lars Jensen Fangel, Leslie B., Marla Wright, Melissa Brakeisen, Nick Mohar Schurz, Orange Patches, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Levinen, Sarah Lyons, Travis Skepko, Stacy Finnegan, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Adorable Susie Summers, Taylor, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, and Tracy Woods. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. I want to again thank you for listening to this episode, and I have a small favor I'd like to ask. I created a survey about the show. It takes less than 2 minutes to complete. I'm planning to make some adjustments moving towards episode 200, and I'd love your input. You can find the link to the survey in the show notes or on trace-evidence.com. That concludes part one of our look into the vanishing of Lynn Burdick. There's so much more to cover and a lot more to this story. So I hope you'll join me next week for part two on the next episode of Trace Evidence.